you. Suit.
Se escribe S-U-I-T, pero la I es muda y se pronuncia
suit.
También puede significar traje, pero en este caso es un verbo y equivale a venir bien.
When it suits you, when it suits her, when it suits them.
Estás escuchando Vaughn Radio. You're listening to Vaughn Radio.
You're listening to Vaughn Radio.
You're listening to Vaughn Radio.
You're listening.
Tune in every day.
Vaughn Radio.
Emprender y liderar, las claves del éxito. Entra ahora en grupovaughn.com/seminario.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughn Radio. Now, for tonight's program, I would like to begin to speak about Napoleon. Napoleon Bonaparte. Napoleon Bonaparte, who became Emperor of France after the French Revolution, became Emperor of France and immediately decided to go to war against the enemies of France, the enemies that had been so close to extinguishing the French Revolution, foreign enemies, getting the French on a war footing, transforming France into a war machine, and these wars being waged to wage a war. This is about the only time you will hear the word to wage. It's a verb. It goes with war, and it's hacer la guerra. Yeah, it's like a frase, a chat. It's an idiom. It goes together. It's a collocation to wage war. Now, waging war all over Europe, and the British fleet, captained by Nelson, Horatio Nelson, Admiral Horatio Nelson, eventually, they triumphed, but at least initially, they did very, very badly. Let's go all the way back to the year 1798. And things were looking very dark for Britain. Remember that Britain was primarily a maritime empire. It was nothing if not its navy, its fleet. Even for the most elementary things, for example, in India, they had a sort of semi-privatized things. It put things in the hands of the East India Company. Well, the situation looked very, very dark. One by one, Britain's allies had either been intimidated or simply defeated at war. In 1797, there was no British fleet in the Mediterranean. Can you imagine that? No British fleet in the Mediterranean, and this is for the first time in what? In a century and a half, right? No British fleet, and very few ports of call, very few ports where a British ship was free to enter. Gibraltar, obviously, in British hands, but Malta and Naples, Napoles. So, yeah, you can imagine, not in the Black Sea, not in the Adriatic Sea, not anywhere. And the French had converted the Mediterranean into a kind of a Mare Nostrum, right? Their little lake, their private lake. Bonaparte had revitalized the French army and transformed it into a formidable fighting force and set them loose in Italy. All of Italy, except for Naples. And Naples would soon come after that. He returned to Paris, where they loved him. And, of course, the directorate at that time was the people nominally in charge, successors of the, you know, the originals of the French Revolution, the directorate. Well, again, Napoleon began to request an army with which to conquer Egypt. And the directorate felt much happier with Napoleon being far away from Paris. Now, at this time, the Ottoman Empire was not what it had been previously. It was not the power it had been previously. And very soon, the Ottoman Empire was going to be called the sick man of Europe. In its end, it was finally almost lost. It imploded. And it was only in the 1920s that a new Turkey was revitalized and came out of that empire. But all during the 19th century, the Ottoman Empire was decadent, rotting, slowly falling away. And they knew it. They knew it. Egypt had technically been part of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottomans, by the way, had for the longest time received a special treatment and had a special connection to France. There had been a time when the Ottoman Navy had spent the winter at the port of Toulon. The Mediterranean port of Toulon. The locals, of course, had all been forced to leave. Their houses had been requisitioned, and the contact with the Turks limited. But still, this kind of hospitality, unheard of by a Christian kingdom, certainly. But yes, the French connection with the Ottoman Empire went way back. And so, France wanted Egypt, and it was going to have Egypt. I mean, the fact is that the Mamluks, ex-slaves of the Ottomans, had taken over, and now they were in charge in Egypt. And think of it this way. If France controls Egypt, then it controls the Red Sea. If it controls the Red Sea, it controls the gateway to India, which would be a way to diminish the British Empire. And to give them, to give the French, a real foothold, a real start in the conquest of India and who knows, and the Far East. The French Empire was only at its beginning at this point, and Egypt, of course, was the key. French troops could reach India in a few weeks if they only had Egypt. Now, Napoleon, Napoleon adored the idea of Egypt. He had a romantic notion of Egypt. And he wanted to get the most out of this expedition. He decided that he was going to do it right. Remember that back in ancient times, the Romans, the ancient Greeks, they had been convinced that civilization, that their civilization had begun in Egypt, and that they were the heirs, los herederos, to an Egyptian culture, an Egyptian civilization, that Egypt, ancient Egypt, had achieved a level of understanding, of knowledge, that was unsurpassed in their own time. And so, yes, with Napoleon, who wants to emulate the Roman Empire, who wants to emulate Alexander the Great, you can imagine how essential the idea of ancient Egypt is to all of this. And so, as I say, he was determined to do it right. He had, in addition to 31,000 soldiers able to invade and occupy Egypt, he had about 200 of the best scholars, of the best scientists from every discipline. We're talking about geographers, geologists, botanists, cartographers. We're talking about artists. He wanted representations of everything they found there. Archaeologists. What people don't remember is that before the Napoleonic invasion, people didn't know anything about Egypt. After the Napoleonic invasion, people knew everything about Egypt. And, well, it was very, very important. They all gathered in Toulon. As far as I understand, or at least this is a story I heard, it might be anecdotal. It might be apocryphal, right? I cannot attest to its accuracy, to its validity. But the story I heard was that much of this operation was secret, and that the final destination was not revealed to these scholars. So they had their instruments, but they didn't know where they were going. They didn't really know how to dress. They had no preparation. They understood that they were going to Egypt when they arrived in the Nile Delta. And so, yeah, the word had spread. The secrecy, of course, was not total. And so Britain had heard, the Admiralty had heard, that the final destination was Egypt. And so who did they send? Who did they send back into the Mediterranean, back into the las fauces, back into the jaws of danger and desperation? Who else but Admiral Nelson, Horatio Nelson, going back and hoping to stop this invasion before it really got off the ground, hoping that he would be able to prevent, impede the progress of this invasion. So, yes, Nelson, well, about 70 miles from the harbor of Toulon, which, if I remember my geography, is not that far from Nice. In any case, Nelson did not know that the fleet was going to be heading toward Egypt. He did know that preparations were underway for a massive invasion. The logistics were very clear. But Nelson himself had not been informed of the destination. Portugal would have been the correct choice. Portugal would have been the most obvious candidate for an invasion, getting that fleet out of the Straits of Gibraltar and into the Atlantic Ocean. So this is what he was prepared for. Another possibility that had been floating around was Ireland. Ireland, at this time, with a much, much higher population. Remember that the potato famine in the 1830s that caused a demographic collapse in Ireland, and that evidently the population of Ireland today is still inferior to what it was before the hambruna de la patata, right? The potato famine. And many of those people were prepared to fight the British. Many of them had no reason, no affection, no reason to love their masters. Nelson's plan was to wait and see where the enemy was going and then intercept the enemy. But of course, who was it? It was Mike Tyson. Mike Tyson said, everybody has a plan until they punch you in the mouth, right? Hasta que no te den un puñado en toda la boca. Everybody has a plan until they punch you in the mouth. And in this case, it was the weather that punched Nelson in the mouth. There was a severe storm, a local storm, in May, the kind that the Mediterranean is notorious for. And it caught the British fleet in open waters. The flagship, right, Barque Insignia, the flagship lost its masts, los mástiles. The flagship lost the mast, and practically, it came very close to sinking. Now, the other ships, they were blown around. They dispersed. They scattered. They went everywhere. It was going to be very difficult to recombine, to recollect, to get back into formation. And while the British were in this state of, victims of a tempest, right? While the British were fighting the elements, the French decided to sail, and they avoided the storm. They were very lucky. Many of them left port without even being observed by the British. And so, yes, this was unbelievable. Nelson had no choice but to systematically try and recover the initiative, locating an enemy on the open sea in the Mediterranean, locating an enemy fleet, even one that large, is really difficult. And of course, human intelligence, communication, all of that was lacking. In an ocean of tens of thousands of square kilometers, you can imagine the frustration. Now, fact is that if he sent ships, you know, some of his ships in one direction, some of his ships in another direction, then they would no longer be able to communicate with each other. If they got out of sight, right? If the crewman, the one with the sharpest eyes, or the ones with the catalejos, right? The ones with the eyeglasses, the telescope there. If they could not see the flags, if they could not read the language of flags being signaled on those ships, then there would be no way. There would be no way. Now, Nelson, with no idea what to do, received orders from Gibraltar, new orders. But of course, the orders made it clear that nobody in England or in Gibraltar knew anything more than Nelson did. And so the orders made it clear that he was supposed to look in the Adriatic, in the Mediterranean, in the Aegean, in the Black Sea, look for a missing Napoleon. And the French, Gibraltar, maybe a candidate, Sicily, maybe Malta, Naples. The fact is that nobody had even thought about the possibility of Napoleon invading Egypt. Nobody, it had not occurred to anyone. In retrospect, retrospect, we also say hindsight. Hind from behind, sight, of course, from vision. So retrospect or hindsight. And we also have a phrasal verb. We can say looking back. So yes, in retrospect, in hindsight, looking back, it is so obvious, so logical, so strategically inevitable that the French would go to Egypt. But no, it didn't occur to anybody in the Admiralty, and it didn't occur to anybody, any intermediates, anybody on Gibraltar. Now, when the British were ready to sail again, 10 days had already passed. That meant that the French could be a great distance away in any direction. The first port of call was Naples. Naples, a friendly port, with supplies and the possibility of repair. The British ambassador, Lord William Hamilton, was knowledgeable and well-connected. His wife was extremely attractive, and of course, the rest is history. Nelson and the wife had had a thing, and evidently, Mr. Hamilton, Lord William, didn't mind, because he knew But evidently he didn't mind. In any case, Naples it was. Naples is where they went. France's ambassador to Naples revealed the final destination. Now, this is very strange because it would have been a top secret. I mean, this is comparable to treason on the part of the ambassador. However, well, the cat was out of the bag. This is una frase hecha que utilizamos, right? Somebody had spilled the beans.
Revelado el pastel.
Let the cat out of the bag or spill the beans.
Verter los frijoles.
Well, there's no way to, another metaphor, very, very frequent and, actually much, much more modern. You cannot put toothpaste back into the tube, right? Once the toothpaste is out of the tube, you cannot put it back in. And so, yes, the French ambassador, once the destination of Napoleon's fleet was public knowledge, there was going to be nothing to stop Nelson. Okay, I have to take a break. I'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
You're listening to Vaughn Radio. You're listening
to Vaughan Radio.
Hay una palabra en inglés en la que aparece tres veces la letra A pronunciada de tres formas diferentes. ¿Sabrías decirnos cuál? Tienes dos minutos para pensártelo. Ahora te lo decimos.
Es el momento de poner en marcha nuevos proyectos. Es el momento de alcanzar el éxito como líder de equipos. De la mano de Richard Vaughan y Javier Fernández Aguado. El próximo 21 de febrero, de 16:30 a 20:30 horas, en la oficina central de Vaughan, en la calle Orense 69, primera planta. Emprender y liderar las claves del éxito. Entra ahora en grupovaughan.com/seminario.
¿No quieres aprender inglés? ¿No quieres conocer expresiones y vocabulario? Ah, entonces no nos busques, porque con nuestros trimestrales mejorarás tu agilidad oral y nivel auditivo y reforzarás la gramática. En grupos reducidos y mediante el método Vaughan aprenderás inglés. Así que no nos llames al 91-133-5833, 91-133-5833, ni nos visites en grupovaughan.com.
Curso intensivo para el First Exam, el programa de Vaughan para superar el examen oficial de Cambridge y obtener el First Certificate, B2. Para más información, grupovaughan.com.
Estás escuchando Vaughan Radio.
You're listening to Vaughan Radio.
You're listening to Vaughan Radio.
You're listening. You're listening to Vaughan Radio.
You're listening. You're listening.
Tune in every day.
Vaughan Radio.
Los cursos trimestrales de Vaughan son ideales para gente que necesita resultados a medio plazo y a un precio asequible. Descúbrelos en grupovaughan.com.
A Vaughan English class is not the same as other English classes. In a Vaughan English class, time is optimized to the max. Every minute counts for your company. Every minute counts for your English. It's all a question of mathematics. The more you practice key structures of the language in every class, the more confident you will be when you use them in real life. And the more effective you will be as a communicator in English. And in this global world of ours, communicating effectively is absolutely key to success. By means of face-to-face classes or video conference classes, Vaughan will make all the difference for your English. And you will make all the difference for your company.
Más información en Barcelona en el 933398687. En Madrid en el 911335831.
A ver, ¿qué pone aquí? Please select the first letter of your model number from The Drop Down Box, The Begging Search. Uf.
¿El inglés se te hace cuesta arriba? Este año te ayudamos a subir la cuesta del inglés con nuestros cursos trimestrales. Clases 100% método Vaughan para todos los niveles que te darán el empujón que necesitas para vencer todas tus dificultades con el idioma. Más información en el 91-133-5833 o en grupovaughan.com.
¿Do you Vaughan? La palabra en inglés en la que aparece tres veces la letra A, pronunciada de tres formas diferentes, es
Australia.
La primera A suena como una O larga, la segunda como el diptongo A y la tercera suena como una A breve.
Australia.
Aprender inglés tú debes. Un regalo a hacerte voy. Toma, con el curso online de Vaughan yo te obsequio.
Apúntate y empieza a aprender inglés donde quieras y cuando quieras. Por menos de un euro al día. Entra en aprendeinglestv.com o llámanos al 91-133-5842 y que el inglés te acompañe.
Estás escuchando Vaughan Radio.
You're listening to Vaughan Radio.
Vaughan Radio. Ven este 13 de febrero a la masterclass que ofrece Richard Vaughan en el Teatro Calderón de Valladolid. Entra en venta de localidades en tcalderón.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughan Radio. On the first part of the program, I was speaking about Napoleon's invasion of Egypt and what that meant for the British Admiral Horatio Nelson. Now, just a little aside, a digression. Napoleon Bonaparte is blamed for damage on the Sphinx, you know, that great monumental sculpture near the pyramids. Now, some people even say that Napoleon used the Sphinx for target practice with his cannon, something like that. This is calumny. This, of course, is a legend to discredit Napoleon. When Napoleon conquered Egypt, all of his artists, all of his historians and scholars, all of his scientists of every imaginable kind. Remember, we are talking about the cream, le crème de la crème, the florinata of the Enlightenment, Illustration. So the best there was at the end of the 18th century. He took them with him. They were called the savants, non los sabios, the savants, the wise men. And he was one of the very first world leaders to recognize the need to preserve intact the country that he was about to invade. The artwork, the culture, the history. He, as I say, he loved Egypt. He had a very romantic idea. Now, there was a battle that took place near the pyramids. That was in July of 1789. The Mamluk forces fought to defend access to Cairo, But of course, the French army, well trained and using superior technology, they were victorious. Now, this idea, this access of the savant, almost immediately coming in with comprehensive reports about ancient Egypt and contemporary Egypt, chronicles, sketches, description de l'Egypte, all of these beautiful, beautiful plates that have come out to us. It has been reproduced many, many times. It was a perennial favorite during the 19th and 20th century. And the fact is that these savants were able to demonstrate that the damage to the Sphinx had already been done. It was there long, long before Napoleon Bonaparte was there. The sand that it had been made from, a kind of limestone, right, cal, or even worse, sandstone, arenisco, that's soft. And the normal desgaste, we call it wear and tear. Wear itself is desgastar, and tear, of course, romper, desgarrar, desgarre. Wear and tear. This is what we say for desgaste in general. So the normal wear and tear of, you can imagine, sandstorms, because Egypt is subject to sandstorms. The nose, the cracks in the face, all of that is easily explainable without any kind of damage by Napoleon or Napoleon's soldiers. That is simple calumny. All right. Now, we are going back to Nelson. Nelson, he knows where Napoleon is now. And Lord Hamilton could not verify independently that what the French ambassador had said was true. In other words, this might be a fiction. This might be some kind of lie, some kind of disinformation technique in order to mislead, no, despistar, to mislead. Now, Hamilton personally believed that Napoleon was going to Malta. And Malta, not so far away from Naples. And this is what he urged, Nelson to follow up on, to do. Sailing from Naples toward Malta, Nelson's ship was met by a British consul from Messina. The Messina, as you know, the Straits of Messina, if the Italian peninsula looks like a boot and Sicily looks like a football that the boot is about to kick, well, that little gap between them, that is the Straits of Messina. And of course, inevitably, they were going to have to go to Malta through the Straits of Messina. The consul living in Messina sailed out to give Nelson the news that Napoleon had, in fact, gone to Malta, that the island had surrendered. It was too late to save Malta, and the French fleet was no longer there. Now, Nelson compounded his own problems. He was, at this point, his own worst enemy. He went to Malta in spite of everything. He was told that Napoleon had sailed away, and that there was no way to stop him, that he had been gone at least 2 weeks. Nelson ignored the report of ships in the area because the French had been gone for so long. And these four ships, by the way, they were part of the fleet. And yes, they were at the rear. They were part of the French invasion. They were toward the rear of the invasion. They were, in fact, what Nelson was looking for. But he himself believed that, yeah, he was too late. And he did not independently corroborate. He didn't check it out. He didn't contrast the information. So, Sicily. That's logical. If you're going to Malta, you might go to Sicily. So yes, if Napoleon's target had been Sicily, then he would have heard of it. So yeah, that was kind of discarded. Nelson, Nelson decided that he would have to go to Alexandria. He was in such a hurry that he ordered his ships to use top speed. In other words, they were not sailing in formation, and that made them vulnerable. And of course, Nelson made an elementary mistake. A mistake that, perhaps this is a British prejudice, because the British Navy was everything in the armed forces. The British Army was just a sort of secondary, inconsequential. The British had no interest in mounting the kind of land campaign that the French, or that the Prussians, that so many of the continental powers were interested in having, right? These enormous numbers of troops that had been trained, that had been drilled to perfection. The British had a very limited number of troops in their army. On yesterday's program, if I remember correctly, yesterday's program, I was talking about the American War of Independence and how the British at that point had been using sort of, well, not mercenaries, but foreign troops from Hesse in Germany, the Hessians, in order to suppress the revolution or the War of Independence in what was going to be the United States, in the 13 colonies in North America. Well, in this case, they didn't really understand how troop carriers do not have the option of going quickly. And if you are trying to transport 31,000 troops across the Mediterranean, then you are going to do it very slowly, which is why those mysterious ships that Nelson had heard about He didn't take them seriously because, by his logic, the French had to be much farther away. By his logic, the ships were going to be going as fast as they could. But no, that didn't happen. What happened was Nelson and his ships went as fast as they could toward Alexandria, and they passed the French fleet. They passed the French fleet because they were not going in formation. They were going simply in line and full sail. They passed by the French fleet without seeing them, without knowing they were there. And, of course, they arrived at Alexandria Harbor and discovered that it was empty, that there were no French. Obviously, you can imagine the consternation, because if the French had not, in fact, gone to Egypt, if the information had been wrong, disinformation, misleading information, then Gibraltar was in danger. Then Ireland was in danger. You can imagine. If the British had been there when the French did arrive, you can imagine tremendous destruction. Tremendous. Yeah. Well, what happened was, Napoleon, well, if the battle had gone the other way, you can imagine, the what if, counterfactual history, we like this in English, the what if, there have been so many books written in what if you go online into pages and pages in internet, there are people very busy writing stories of counterfactual timelines, parallel timelines. What would have happened if? What would have happened if Nelson had been there when Napoleon arrived? If he had killed Napoleon at that point, and much of the, many of the battles in Europe had not taken place. No first consul. No Emperor Napoleon. Nelson lost confidence in his own judgment, and he, just after leaving, or rather, just after arriving, they left. They went up the coast of Syria, and just a day later, the French arrived. Instead of facing the Royal Navy, there was no real resistance. Now, when he did come back, when Napoleon, or rather, Nelson, Horatio Nelson, when he realized his error, he destroyed the French defenders in the Battle of Aboukir Bay, which is usually held up as being one of the great moments in the Napoleonic Wars, one of the most heroic moments in British naval history. But in fact, it was nothing of the kind. In fact, it was a calculated risk in desperation and was entirely temerario. It was entirely reckless. He saw that the French fleet, they were there at anchor in the bay. And naturally, Napoleon and his army, at that point, had won the Battle of the Pyramids. They were the masters of Cairo, and they were exploring the Nile. The fleet was pretty much, you know, on a skeleton crew. But the fleet was vulnerable there at Aboukir Bay. But what he did was to come in between the ships and the shore. And what he did not know at that point was whether the depth of the bay at that point was whether it was deep enough for his ships. His ships could have easily run aground en callarse, right? To run aground. His ships could have run aground. In English, the opposite of deep is shallow, poco profundo. And we can use this metaphorically as well. He's a very deep person. That's a very deep thought, or very shallow person, very we can also say superficial, the way Spanish do. This is a very superficial argument. It's a very shallow argument. Shallow and deep. Shallow and deep. So, for example, when you go to a swimming pool with children, make sure that the children stay in the shallow end of the pool. Or there are other people that tell you, how did you learn to swim? Well, I learned to swim when my father picked me up and threw me in the deep end of the swimming pool. Well, the deep end, the shallow end. If Aboukir Bay had been more shallow, then it would have been Nelson who would have destroyed his own fleet. The fact is that with no fleet, with no reinforcements, the French were not able to have a permanent place in Egypt. With their ships of the line destroyed at Aboukir Bay, they couldn't hold Egypt. Okay. 1 year later, in 1799, Napoleon returned to France with a single ship. Now, he had prepared a massive public relations campaign. Public relations, we also call this PR in English. A massive PR campaign, so that the Parisians were prepared to give him a hero's welcome. And in November of that year, on the 18th Brumière, Napoleon staged a coup d'état, un golpe d'estado, and took control of the French government. 16 years of war, subsequently. 16 years of war in Europe. And all of that is going to mean, it's going to mean for Spain, the loss of government, a complete anarchy, the rise of common people as political actors with these juntas, with the guerra de guerrilla, as something that common people had never experienced before. That their moment in history, going to come out with La Pepa, and in the end, going to come out with independence wars in the colonies. So American independence, except for, of course, Cuba and Puerto Rico. In any case, Napoleon took control. Admiral Nelson, had made a series of mistakes, but still, he was able to focus the PR campaign as well, and he carefully guarded his, you know, his version of the message that got out to the public, and his image. As I think I've mentioned earlier, the beginning of the 19th century was an age where lithographs and all sorts of reproductions of etchings, grabados, litografías, this sort of thing, it became estampitas. It became increasingly popular and increasingly common for this kind of idolatry of celebrities. And both Admiral Nelson and Napoleon Bonaparte were able to successfully transform themselves into celebrities after this particular battle. All right. I seem to have run out of time. Thank you for listening, and please listen to my next program.
You're listening to Vaughn Radio.
You're listening to Vaughn Radio.
You're listening.